You're listening to the Meet the Farmers podcast with me, Ben Eagle. To listen to previous episodes, visit thinkingcountry.com or find the podcast on iTunes by searching for Meet the Farmers. Hello and welcome back to Meet the Farmers. If you listened to the previous episode with Matt Naylor, you'll know that the next few programmes were recorded while on a road trip up to southeast Scotland. In this programme, I finally make it past the border, in fact to the borders, and I'm speaking to diversified dairy farmer Jim Shanks, who farms near Hoyk. So without further ado, let's get started. Hello and welcome to episode 19 of Meet the Farmers, which is coming to you from the Scottish borders. I'm here with Jim Shanks at Standhill Farm, a 500-acre diversified dairy farm producing about 2 million litres of milk per year, as well as 1,600 megawatts of electricity, 8,500 megawatts of renewable heat, and 300 tonnes of red tomatoes. That might sound strange, but you'll hear more about that later. Jim, along with his wife Kerry, are the fifth generation of the Shanks family to be farmers, and the third generation here at Standhill. At its heart, this is a dairy farm, but it's no ordinary dairy business with an anaerobic digester, a biomass plant, a woodchip boiler, and a tomato greenhouse system, all part of the mix. Jim, thank you so much for speaking to me today. You're my first Scot on the podcast.
Oh, but surely not the last.
I hope not. We mentioned in the chat before that your family's been here since the 50s. How has the farm and the business changed since that time?
Well, I guess when my grandfather bought this farm in the 50s, that he wasn't unusual in being a dairy farm in this area, and that there was many dairy farms, small dairy farms in the neighbourhood. But I guess bit by bit, due to the, I think, commitment that dairy farming requires, is that the other farms then turned into beef, arable, and that we are the only one left in the immediate area. There are some still rather large dairy farms in the borders, but we've remained as a dairy farm and not really expanded a huge amount. We're more diversified than farming, but... Yeah. But yes, we are, I guess, a traditional dairy farm at heart, passed down through the family, and we are now got the next generation on its way with two daughters and a son.
What was it like growing up on the farm?
It was a rural community, so you were very much just the same as everybody else growing up. Most of my friends at school were farmers' sons and daughters, so we saw the changes growing up, but there was some things that were very special about growing up in a rural community, and I think a lot of people can relate to blocks and tractor pedals when you're 10 years old in a cut silage field learning how to drive a tractor, and our first tractor.
Going in all directions.
Yeah. I remember Dad getting our first four-wheel drive tractor in 1985. He bought it at a farm sale in 1985, and we've still got the same tractor to this day. So again, like every other kid in a rural area, there's just certain things that you can do on a farm that nobody else gets to do. But we were very much the normal. The only thing that wasn't normal about us was that we were dairy farming, and that I hardly ever saw Dad, because he was either out by the time we were up in the morning, and he was in slightly later than we got in. But
yeah, exactly what that was like growing up myself.
Yeah, and my mother, she's from a dairy farm through in Ayrshire, so she knew exactly. So it was sort of taken for granted that this is the way of life that we occupied. Never really known anything else. Maybe up until now, we're maybe starting to do things a little bit different. But until then, you never thought anything about working every weekend, working into the night. It was just the done thing.
Can you tell me a bit about the local area?
The borders is unique. I've been around and seen the world, and I come back and I still don't think that I've seen anywhere that's quite as different as Hoyk. And it's got its positives and its negatives, and some say it's a slightly backward place, but as you get older you begin to see the positives in the local area that you grow up in. It's a very close-knit community. Nobody toots a horn in Hoyk High Street out of anger. It's always accompanied by a wave, and everybody knows everybody. It's very much a local village here. Rugby is still the be-all and end-all in the Borders, especially in Hoyk. We are just surrounded in this community by ex-Scottish internationals and British Lions players that have just grown up working in Borders farms and in Borders communities that have went on to play rugby.
Perfect background for it.
Absolutely. And the common ridings and the rugby, the knitwear, the mills, the farming, that is Borders community, and it's an identity that's still very much there to this day.
Let's turn towards your dairy. How many head are you milking, and how has that changed over the years?
We're milking about 175 head, and I haven't really pushed the numbers. Dad always used to milk 144 head, and that was 72 each side. He had 72 high yielders, 72 low yielders, and if my maths are right, that'll add up to 144. early noughties, the early part of this century, I came home from college full of new ideas and crap, and decided, yeah, we've got to get bigger. We've got to, yeah. You know, usual nonsense that goes through dairy farmers' minds. And so we put a new parlour on, we new silage pits, we convert an old shed, and we did the drastic thing of upping numbers from 144 to about 180. And that was, I guess, in 2006 that it came online. And so we've kept it at that numbers. I'm of the opinion, rightly or wrongly, that increasing numbers is just increasing the size of stick to hit myself with. But as I say, rightly or wrongly, we are on a Tesco contract. Tesco are very, very good to us, and we enjoy being with them. We've been with them since 2007. But I'm not one for putting more eggs in the same basket.
So a couple of years ago, you couldn't really read anything in the farming press without something being mentioned about fluctuating prices, which is really the story of dairying, year to year, season to season. Have you suffered from volatile prices in the past?
Oh yeah, in the past, before the Tesco contract started, the prices were going up and down, and I think we had a family discussion, and that we kind of says, well, if the price goes below this level, then the cows are going, and
it got close,
and we just said that we weren't working our backsides off so that other people can make the margins out of the milk. We just, at that point, that was maybe around 2004, 2005, 2006, somewhere in about there. I can't remember the exact date. But we said, there's more to life than this. There's more to life than killing yourself to produce milk for somebody that doesn't really want it. Mm. Tesco then came in, and ever since they came in, they stabilised the price, they gave us certainty, and credit must go where it's due. We've been very, very happy with Tesco. And that's where we still are to this day.
So we mentioned in the introduction that this is a fairly diversified dairy farm, and I'm fascinated by the tomato operation specifically. But what came first? The idea for the tomatoes, the anaerobic digester for the slurry, or did both come into your mind at the same time in terms of how to make this work?
No, I did a Nuffield scholarship in 2009, 2010.
You're another Nuffield. I didn't know you were a Nuffield.
Yes.
It's funny how you got around.
Yeah, the funny handshake didn't obviously come through there. So I shouldn't say that. I'll get slaughtered for saying that. I'd done enough field 2009, 2010, looking at energy from agriculture, and that was before sort of renewable energy became sexy. I travelled Sweden, Denmark and Germany. I saw lots of windmills. I looked at all sorts of renewable energy, but I guessed where I thought we had most potential here on the farm and in the UK in general was wind and gas. My wife says it's my specialist subject is wind and gas. I tried for wind turbines, and the minute I was applying for wind turbines was the minutes the councils were just pulling up the drawbridge and saying no more. So I had a bit of a predicament, because I knew I could do anaerobic digestion as well, but my grid connection was way too expensive. And actually, after a lot of prolonged negotiations with Scottish Power, they managed to actually find me a grid connection that suited me. So we got the anaerobic digester through. The glass house, I guess, came from Sweden, Denmark and Germany, where I was seeing large AD plants and a glass house next to the AD plant. So I thought, well, I can understand what they're doing there. They're putting the heat and the carbon dioxide through their waste products. They're putting that through the glass house and making it productive. And I thought, well, maybe one day when I get my AD plant, then I'll have a look at it. But I guess maybe there was a wee bit of an overlap that I was looking, trying to get the AD plant through planning and get the grid connection for it. And I did start looking at glass houses. And I guess I got the bug. I really got the bug for a glass house environment. Mm. Everywhere I was doing my homework for the glass house, doors were opening. And I'd never had that before, because the AD plant and the wind turbine, you were always used to getting doors slammed in front of your face and having to knock them down to get through them. Whereas with a glass house, doors were just opening left, right and centre. I kept expecting there to be a showstopper somewhere. It never materialised, and I kept going and going. And there was things that didn't work, like... The amount of heat the AD plant was going to produce was only going to be about a tenth of what an economically sized viable glass house would need. But then I thought, well, no, we can do it with biomass boilers and wood chip and fill the gap that way. So there was chinks in the way, but nothing that I couldn't get around fairly easily. And goodness, in about 2015, I sat down with the family, because I always feel it's very important to get the family on board with a family farm. And I don't go spending silly amounts of money without having the full backing of the family. And if they don't back me, then I don't do things. We'd got mum and dad away to look at some glass houses, see what they thought. And while they were sceptical at first, they came round to the idea. I think they kind of got the bug a little bit like me. Mm-hmm. And we then went past a point of no return. We got the funding and went for it.
How did it go down in the local community? What was the planning phase like?
Oh, well, you know, there's the countryside is full of whinging assholes that no matter what you do, they will... There's a phrase, what is it, the last one into paradise thinks they've got the right to pull the ladder up behind them. And that's... It's a phrase that I see come back to me time and time again. It doesn't matter what you do, there's an army of whingers out there. By this time, I'd learned to be fairly cute in how you work with the press, how you work with the local community, and that you be as open as you possibly can with them, take them with you, and isolate the naysayers. And by this time, of all my planning experience, by the time I got to the glass house, I was pretty good at it. And also, I think the local council was in the mood to say, come on, Jim, just... Yeah. Get this built, yeah. Get it on with it. We're behind you on this because we don't like them either.
So clearly this place is all about innovation and your determination has driven that. But do you think farmers across the country, and by country I'm referring to both Scotland and the UK as a whole, are receiving enough support to encourage innovation, and what more could be done?
I guess innovation has to come from the individual. And actually, some of the most innovative stuff I saw on my travels came from America. Now, you would think that America isn't that much behind renewable energy, that sort of stuff, but the individuals drive it, and that will always be the case. I have my issues with government, with local government, and bureaucracy more than anything else. I think the bureaucracy that is the biggest industry in the UK by a long way. People talk about insurance and pharmaceuticals. Bureaucracy is by far and away a bigger industry. And I think people are starting to see the backlash of that with the way they're voting in America, that they've voted in a president, no matter how bad he is, they're voting in somebody that's going to get rid of bureaucracy and lower taxes. So that's bureaucracy is a problem, but yeah, it comes down to the individual. It's no government. If government steps in, they generally tend to make things worse. So for governments to start coming in and trying to support guys like me, they can get out the way and help me no end. But when they actually come in and try to do something positive, they generally tend to make things worse.
Mm. It's important that the market drive. Oops. Yeah,
that's what it has to be at the end of the day. And that if you're not, you can be as innovative as you like, but if you're not producing stuff that people want, then there's no point doing it. So that's always the end game and what has to be remembered.
What, if anything, is holding your business back from further growth?
Debt. We shall pay off a bit more before we start pushing forward. Ach, the other thing is that I've got a young family, and I don't want to be the richest man in the graveyard. So with those two things, just paying back, I think the fancy word's consolidation of debt. We are borrowed heavily, and we're a successful business. We're not a money tree, but we're a successful business, and we shall repay some of that debt. But also, the at times when we built the biogas, but more so the glass house and getting the glass house established, the stress has been at times unbearable. So we've got three young kids, and our son, last child, was just born in January. So I don't want them to say, yeah, look at all Daddy's glass house. He's an anaerobic digester, but he's buried 6 feet in the ground just down the road. So I've got to watch those things.
Oh, this is the B section now, the Brexit bit. We've got to have someone. Relating to Scottish agriculture being dealt with as fundamentally different from the rest of the UK, do you think that's the case? And do you think that Scotland should have a special case in some sort of Brexit deal when it comes to farming, food and farming?
Personally, yes, because I'm not a believer in Brexit. I think it was the vote was there for the wrong reason. I think it was an inward-looking vote. I think a lot of people voted Brexit because they didn't really think it was going to happen. However, I don't think that there's any appetite to reverse the decision. So in that circumstances, they just got to get on with it. I would absolutely love if Scotland got its own deal and got a slightly, shall we say, softer Brexit than the UK. I think that would really, really boost Scotland's economy as a hub within the UK, but within the EU as well. I think that there could be, and if that means a hard border, then that means a hard border. I don't think that will happen. I don't think that will happen. I think Brexit is what it is. We've made our bed, and we've got to lie in it.
The farmers take up most of your time, but do you do anything else away from farming, or go somewhere else to get your mind? You mentioned stress earlier, to get your mind away from the business.
Well, I play in a brass band. Oh, yeah. I play trombone in the brass band.
I'm a trombonist as well.
Oh, goodness.
Fellow trombonist, there we are.
So, it's two very busy times a year in the band. One is the Common Riding, which has just passed, and the other one's Christmas time. So the brass band takes up quite a fair bit of the time. I enjoy it as a social entity rather than trying to be the best brass bander that ever was. We're experiencing normal things in the brass band, trying to encourage kids in, but unfortunately I blame it on American Pie that just knocked any sort of desire of any kid that wants to play in a brass band on the head after they've watched that film. But yeah, what else did I do? Oh yeah, I a couple of years ago I do directors here and there, and director of the local agricultural society and local show and the machinery ring and all that carry on. But the other thing I did was I did a pantomime for the Young Farmers, and that was quite interesting. We managed not to get sued at the end of it, which was always a bonus. So I believe we're going to do another one this year. We've got our first meeting there, so that'll take up a lot of time. But I enjoy football. I enjoy rugby. I was made to play rugby against my will at school. Going to Hoyk High School, everybody's made to play rugby against their will, even. But the rugby thing, very, if it's accompanied, if anything's accompanied by a beer, I'll show an interest in it, I guess. So.
Right, I think we'll go and look at the glass houses, if that's okay.
Yep, super.
Just walking into the glass house now, what are the dimensions? How big is this place?
200 metres by 80 metres, so we're 4 acres. 1.6 hectare, 4 acres.
And how many different varieties have been growing in here?
I mean, we've got a few varieties. We break it down, really, in layman's terms, into half the glass house is in wee tomatoes, half the glass house is in big tomatoes. So within the wee tomatoes, there's baby plum that we pick loose. There's baby plum that are picked on the vine. There's cherry that's on the vine, and then there's the big tomatoes which are sold on the vine for the other half.
And when you started up, did you outsource the management? Did you do it in house?
Yeah, our manager's a guy called Mark Wilkinson, he's got 38 years experience in managing glasshouses. So you can imagine, if you had 38 years experience managing a dairy farm, you'd know everything there is to know about dairy. So Mark came here and he knew everything there was to know. The difference between this glasshouse and any other glasshouse was that the staff knew nothing. So every member of staff that we took on under Mark had to be trained up. But it was doable. It was doable. You couldn't probably do it in a dairy farm, because all the jobs kind of come at once, but in the glasshouse it comes job by job by job. So he had that opportunity. So that's how it's worked. And the guys now are in their second year, so they now know where they're going. They now know what the end goal is, and that they're not just doing the jobs. So I guess I would use the analogy, what is it, bricklayers and cathedral builders, that last year were bricklayers because they're just putting one brick in front of the other, whereas this year they know what the end goal is, what their fruit's to look like, and so that's how they're working this year.
Any big lessons learned?
Oh yes. there's a few lessons that I'll put away in my back pocket. I have every farmer in Scotland wanting now to put on a glasshouse. That's not quite true, but people see this as a diversification thing. So I'm not letting away the secrets of my most harsh lessons learnt, because there are certain things that you can't do in a Scottish glasshouse that you can do everywhere else, but you can't do in a Scottish glasshouse. So I'll keep that to myself. But yeah, big lesson. And we're still learning. And it's like a crop, any other crop that you grow, if you make a balls of it one year, then that's it for the year. You've
one chance.
Yeah, and then your next chance is next year. So you've got to try and carry it through as best you possibly can.
So in simple terms, can you describe the process, say, going right the way from the girls at the other end of the farm through to the tomatoes as an end product here? Describe the process.
Okay, so the cows produce three things. They produce crap, heat and milk. We take the milk off them. The heat we can't do anything about coming off the cows, but the cow slurry is effectively everything that cow can't process. So the cow can process the food and turn it into milk and turn it into heat. What it can't process goes through it. So we capture the slurry, we put it into the anaerobic digester, and the anaerobic digester wrings out the last bit of energy that the cow couldn't do. We also feed some whole crop into the anaerobic digester. We get the methane from that, we run the gas engine. The gas engine produces three things because it's connected to a generator. It produces heat, carbon dioxide and electricity. We use the electricity to run the farm. Everything round about here, I always say, everything round about here runs in cow shit. Whether it's the car, whether it's the lights, the kettle, everything runs in cow shit. What we do with the carbon dioxide gets fed into the glasshouse. The heat is then used to dry wood chip. And so we will buy in a lot of wet wood chip. We will dry it with the heat for the biogas. But the heat from the biogas, while it can dry a lot of wood chip, it can't heat the glasshouse. So what we then do is feed the dry wood chip into the biomass boilers, and the biomass boilers heats the glasshouse. And then there's things like when we're finished with the tomato crop, it goes back in the anaerobic digester, we can use the rock wool for bedding the young stock. So there's a lot of things where it can all go back round as well.
Where do you get your wood from?
Some of it comes from on farm. But generally just local felling. We have a lot of wood in the Scottish Borders, but some of it is bought in and seasoned, seasoned then bought in. Some of it comes in wet and we dry it ourselves. But it's all sort of local timber, and it's getting tight in supply. Timber, wood is getting really, really tight for a number of reasons.
I suppose, I mean, that's another whole debate, which I know I'm touching on tomorrow at the Highland Show, is this agriculture forestry question. Where do you see it going?
Well, I happen to think that the squeeze really is on land. That we've talked about this coming for a number of years. The squeeze is on. The demand there, because of we are expecting land to produce energy as well as food. So you've got straw going into power stations, you've got wood going into power stations, you've got crops, thousands of acres going into biogas. There is a huge demand from land, and so bedding prices, straw prices rising, And that I really do feel in this last year, couple of years, the squeeze now really is on, and that farmers like myself are really going to have to think what they're going to do with the land and how they're going to use it, because the old ways, where they had free rein for lots of cheap inputs into their farm, isn't going to be there from now on and in the future. I think the squeeze is on.
What makes a good tomato?
Ripened on the vine. So quite often you'll buy Moroccan tomatoes or Spanish or Israeli, and they've been picked not ripe, and they've been allowed to ripen in transit. There's only certain sugars you'll get if you ripen on the vine. So because our turnaround's pretty quick, we are selling a product that's more ripe when it's picked. So that helps. Getting it local. The other big, the massive thing about tomatoes is don't put them in the fridge. Just don't put tomatoes anywhere near a fridge. The tomatoes used to be grown in this environment at 25 degrees heat, and then you put it in a fridge, and I think once the tomato goes below about 8 degrees, the whole biology of the fruit starts fighting against itself, and it all goes into a bit of a mess. So it'll actually keep better out with the fridge, but it'll taste a whole lot better as long as it's not put in the fridge.
And in terms of timing of ripening, so at the moment we're looking on the vine, there's some very green ones at the base, and then as you work up to the top, they slowly turn more yellow to orange and then to red. What's the time process?
When a flower is pollinated, it'll then take 53 days till fruit ripening and picking. So that's the sort of time scale that we're on. When it's picked loose, so the tomatoes you're looking at are actually picked loose, but you get to pick the tomato when it's absolutely on the money. Whereas if you're picking on the vine, you're always compromising. You're compromising between the top ones maybe being a wee bit further on than they should be, yeah, and the bottom ones just about there.
Yeah.
So the vine, you're asking to pick 8 tomatoes or however, you know, it can be 10, 12 tomatoes at one point. So you will compromise the top ones, you'll compromise the bottom ones. The vine does look fantastic though in a pack. It's and the vine gives it the smell as well. So you know when you're buying on the vine, you get that smell, and we see it in local shops. Some of the local shops that supply, you just go into the shop and you just smell the tomatoes straight away, and it's great. It's a real sales point, being able to have that smell in the shop, and people say, "Ooh, where's that coming from?"
How would you describe? Would you still describe yourself as a dairy farmer who has diversified? Because obviously, yeah, your knowledge and your passion for this side of the business is evident.
No, I'll always be a dairy farmer. It's 80% of my time still spent in the dairy. I am going to learn how to grow tomatoes properly off Mark, and by the time Mark retires, I will hopefully know how to. I know every ins and outs about growing tomato crop, but I will always be a dairy farmer. What stresses me out is the case of mastitis we had last night. It's the downer cow. It's the stillbirth. These are the things that stress me out, and that I just get a real kick out of healthy cows producing well, looking well, and happy cows, and that'll never change. I have a massive emotional connection to the cows, and I think most dairy farmers have it. Some of them will admit it more than others, but my emotional connection is very, very strong.
You're confident about the future of the dairy industry in Scotland?
No. we've been given two things. There's two things that our business has thrived on over the last, say, 10 years. One is the Tesco contract. The other one is EU subsidy. And they were both given. And what can be given can be taken away. I have whispered every now and again that if it wasn't for Tesco, I wouldn't be in dairying. I'm not willing to put up with price fluctuation. As I mentioned earlier, I am not busting my gut out. Dairying, once you can do dairying, you can do anything. Once you've got the expertise, once you've got the commitment, once you've got the people management, once you've got the science behind, you can do anything. Dairying is a massively complex job. It requires that you be an electrician, a plumber, a bovine gynecologist. It's everything, and it's a lot of work, and I'm not doing that for nothing. But again, it's what given can be taken away, and it may well be. You never ever know what the future holds, and the one thing that's constant is change, so that may be the case.
Well, on that somber note, I think we'll probably leave it there. But no, thank you, Jim, so much. It's been really fascinating seeing what is a complex but really linked and understandable business. Wish you all the best for the future, definitely.
Thank you very much.
Who'd have thought it? Milk and tomatoes, but clearly Jim is making it work. Next time, we're sticking in the borders and we're also staying with dairying and diversification, but with a very different business. I'll be speaking to Martin Burgess at Overlangshaw Farm. If you are diversified in your social media, a reminder that you can follow me and my witterings on Twitter or on Instagram at Benji_Eagle. Benji is B-E-N-J-Y. Thank you very much for listening and for your ongoing support. Please do subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and tell your friends and family about it. Also, I'd love to hear if you have any feedback. You can find my contact details at thinkingcountry.com. Until next time then on Meet the Farmers.